why not? This article is obviously about sulfyl transferases. So there's clearly a thread from you know.
This is the culmination of the project that started with the Pew funding.
Okay.
So it is appropriate. So the short story is that, and again, this was did come from the work that I did as a postdoc in Steve Rosen's group. So Steve, for many years, had been interested in lymphocyte recirculation through lymph nodes. And this is part of the normal immune response. So lymphocytes are your T cells and your B cells. Okay, and their job is to patrol your body and look for foreign invaders, like bacteria and viruses. And when they encounter those foreign invaders, they have to communicate with each other, and then that stimulates an immune response. But statistically, these T cells and B cells would never, so the right T cell and the right B cell would never find each other if they were just flying around your body, because there's just so much volume to cover. And so the job of the lymph node is to collect them and concentrate them in this organ so that they're much more likely to encounter each other. And so we have this thing called immunosurveillance, where your T cells and B cells exit the bloodstream, go through the lymph nodes, sort of sample each other, and then go back through the lymphatics and into the blood again, and they just do this continuously. They recirculate. And lymph nodes, you have hundreds of lymph nodes throughout your body. You know, they're here and they're in your armpit, and it just all are hundreds. And so it's an interesting topological problem, because the blood system is a closed system, and yet these T cells and B cells have found a way to exit out of the bloodstream and enter the lymph node tissue. So they've sort of crossed over this barrier, which is made up of endothelial cells that line the blood vessels. And so Steve, for his career, has been really interested in how that happens. Back in the 1980s, late 80s, it was discovered that there's a protein on the lymphocytes called L-selectin, and it's binding to ligands that are on the endothelial cells, but only in these lymph nodes. And those ligands turned out to be sulfated polysaccharides, but that wasn't known until later in the 90s, and that was work that I contributed to as a postdoctoral fellow. So at the time that I went to Steve's lab, it was known that, yeah, there was some carbohydrates, they were binding to this receptor L-selectin, this was important in lymphocyte recirculation. They knew that they were sulfated because of some metabolic radiolabeling experiments. So they put hot sulfate into the lymph node organ culture, and this radiolabeled sulfate ended up in these glycoproteins. But they didn't know what the structure was. And so I had been following the story in the literature. I said, oh, you know, they need me to come into the lab and help them figure out the structure. So I talked my way into a postdoctoral position. And so while I was in Steve's lab, we discovered exactly what is the structure of this polysaccharide, you know, exactly what were the sugars and how are they linked together and where were the sulfates. And the other thing we discovered is that the sulfates were absolutely critical for the binding of this receptor. So the sulfate, without the sulfate there, the binding was really weak. But with the sulfate there, it was really strong. So the sulfate was a switch. And I thought that was really profound because, like, sulfate as a chemical group is kind of similar to phosphate. And inside your cell, you have a lot of phosphorylation pathways. And you've probably talked to other Pew scholars who work on kinases and phosphatases and signaling pathways. This is a huge area of biology. And every biologist knows that, you know, phosphorylation of proteins can change their properties and lead to a signal transduction event. And I thought it was really interesting that here was another example of biological regulation, but instead of phosphate, it was sulfate. And instead of proteins, it was sugars, you know? This is like early 90s, okay? Now, if you sort of dug around the literature at that point, you could actually find a few examples out there of other receptor-ligand interactions outside the cell that were governed by sulfation of a sugar. And so, you know, those of us who were working in Steve's lab started wondering, well, maybe there's actually a paradigm here. You know, maybe one can think of sulfation of sugars more broadly as a way to regulate their function as we think of phosphorylation of proteins. And maybe there's, in fact, whole families of enzymes that put sulfate onto sugars and modulate them, and activate them or deactivate them, just as there's a family called the kinases that put phosphate on proteins. And at the time, there was only one such enzyme there called sulfotransferases that was known in human. And this was, again, before the human genome became publicly available in its entirety. But there were a few bits and pieces of the genome around at that point. You could get EST databases and so on. And so And so what we did is we took this one known gene and did a blast analysis, and out popped a whole bunch of ESTs that looked like relatives of that enzyme from the human genome. And that led to the discovery of a family of sulfotransferases. And so we, at the time, you know, in Steve's lab and with some collaborators, we called those the GST family of sulfotransferases. And there were, I think now there's 7 of them. And other people had discovered other sulfotransferases. So by the year 2000, there were like about 50 known sulfotransferases from the human genome. As opposed to one, which was the case 5 years earlier. You know, so the field, right. You really started to get a sense of that there's a superfamily and that there's all this sulfation going on, and it could be very broadly involved in biological regulation. And that's what I wanted to study as on the faculty at Berkeley. So that's what Pew funded. Mm-hmm. And so when I came to Berkeley, I wanted to pursue this GST family of sulfotransferases in more detail and from more of a chemistry perspective. And so there were a couple of different lines of inquiry that we pursued. One was a very sort of practical line of inquiry. So it turns out that one of these GSTs not only sulfated these polysaccharides in the lymph node and was important for recirculation in the lymph node, but it also sulfated polysaccharides at sites of chronic inflammation. And it turns out that a chronically inflamed tissue, like the joint of someone with arthritis, it starts to look like a lymph node. So the tissue starts to reorganize itself and gets remodeled, and the T cells and the B cells form zones and germinal centers, and all these genes get induced that are normally lymph node genes. And so including the sulfotransferase, so it was induced in these inflamed tissues, and the sulfated sugars were getting expressed on these blood vessels, and all of a sudden, you know, you'd get recruitment of leukocytes, all kinds of white blood cells, into this tissue, which was not a lymph node, and that would cause damage of the tissue, and that's the pathology of inflammation. So, you know, one of the fundamental goals in the pharmaceutical industry is to keep those leukocytes out of the tissue, to keep them from attaching to the blood vessel walls and creeping through the blood vessels. And since the sulfated polysaccharide was really important for the cell-cell binding event, you know, it was clear if you blocked sulfation, you might block the whole cascade of events. And that was sort of validated with a knockout mouse in which that sulfotransferase was deleted. So in my lab, one of our first projects was to try and figure out how do you develop drugs, you know, that target sulfotransferases, like really a very medicinal chemistry approach. So we worked on that. The other thing we worked on, which is this, and this took about 5 years to really come to fruition. So this is a long project with one heroic graduate student starting from day one and now starting his 6th year with his first paper. Wow. I mean, this is really heroic. He was interested in what is the difference? So again, we now know there are 50 sulfotransferases. And it turns out they come in subcategories. So 5 of them are GLCNAC 6 sulfotransferases. So they'll put sulfate onto a sugar called N-acetylglucosamine at the 6 hydroxyl group. And why are there like 5 of them? Why do we need 5? And that's like saying, if you look at the kinase superfamily, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of kinases in the human genome, like 800 or so. Several hundred of those are tyrosine kinases. They all put phosphate on tyrosine. So what's the difference between them all? Well, it's, you know, they target different tyrosines within different protein substrates. So they, you know, there's a context in which they'll recognize their particular tyrosine of interest and phosphorylate that protein. And so we were wondering, like, where does specificity come from within these GLCNAC 6 sulfotransferases? Like, why does this one put sulfate on the GLCNAC residue in this particular polysaccharide, but not in any other? With this other one, we'll find a GLCNAC in this other polysaccharide. Where does that come from? And so this student spent a couple years probing the in vitro substrate specificity of these enzymes. So he synthesized a bunch of polysaccharides. That's not easy. And cloned and expressed these enzymes and developed in vitro assays. That wasn't easy. And what he found in vitro is that all of these enzymes behave identically. There's just no difference between them. And yet in vivo, they are able to find different glycoproteins to sulfate on different GLCNAC residues. And so there was obviously some information encoding their specificity in the cell that wasn't outside of the cell. And so we're like, okay. So it was clear we had to study them inside the cell. Okay, so now we had to develop a way to look at their activities, their substrate specificities, all in a cell. And these are enzymes of the Golgi compartment. So they're membrane-associated within the Golgi stacks. So the student made somewhere over 100 stable cell lines that were engineered to express different members of the sulfotransferase family together with different enzymes that build different kinds of polysaccharides. And he developed antibodies to probe the sulfated polysaccharide products on the cell surface by flow cytometry and microscopy. Guy's a chemist, you know, and he had learned all this cell biology. And what he discovered after all of this was that what gives these different enzymes specificity for different targets has nothing really to do with the way their catalytic domain binds the substrate, which you might have suspected is the simplest explanation. Instead, it has to do with their differential distribution in the Golgi compartment. So some of them are really early in the Golgi, and some of them are really late in the Golgi, and some of them are distributed throughout the entire Golgi. And so those enzymes that are really early in the Golgi have access to different types of structures than those enzymes that are really late in the Golgi. And so there's kind of a temporal and spatial contribution to the substrate specificity that has not much to do with the actual catalytic domain of the enzymes. And that was a really fundamentally new discovery that explains how the system works and what the real difference is between these enzymes and why when you knock out this one, that one doesn't compensate because it's not in the right place. And he made a lot of chimeric enzymes where he would take the localization domain of one and put it on the catalytic domain of the other and have them swapping places in the Golgi compartment. It was just a brilliant piece of work, you know, and to pull this off, it required a really detailed understanding of the glycobiology, the biosynthetic pathways, the structures of the polysaccharides, how to do the genetics, he did a lot of really glorious pictures in here, so, you know, deconvolution fluorescence microscopy, and, you know, no one in my lab knew how to do that at the time. He had to figure all this out, like, on his own, just by hanging around. Like, you know, he's got these figures with T panels, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, you know, I mean, just really nice, and heavy-duty quantitation, you know, because you're always open to artifacts, and so when we put this paper together, it took a while to get this thing all together, you know, and now he has this model for how Golgi, how these biosynthetic pathways take place and how enzymes located in different places will sulfate in different ways and so on. And I just know it's a brilliant piece of work. And no one else might ever really know that, but because it's such a complicated system, two people in the world might read this paper, you know. Mm. But I know, you know, right. What it is. So, you know, yeah, well, it's not a science paper, but it's, because who could have fit it in a journal like Science, but it's it's a really nice piece of biochemistry.
Yeah. Well, we talked again, I'll bring this up from yesterday about, you know, pedigrees and where the politics of publication and, you know, worrying about who you work with and science, particularly in the biomedical area, moves at a dramatic pace. And how do you encourage students to do these kinds of projects and do this heroic effort?
It's hard for him because, you know, especially chemists, like synthetic chemistry, you tend to publish at a much quicker rate than if you're like a cell biologist or something. Yeah. And it's not uncommon for a synthetic chemist to publish 10, 15, 20 even papers in the course of a PhD. It was very unusual for like a cell biologist to do that. They might have two or three papers, and that's great, you know. And so it was hard for Chris because his classmates were like pounding out all these little communications, and he's like slogging away, you know, finally had this one monstrous paper. And so I had to do a lot of cheerleading, you know. I had to say, but Chris, it's not quantity, it's quality. And of course, in reality, it's both, right?
Right.
And but we don't say that to our students. And, you know, I had to do, like, Chris, you know, this is such an important piece of work that this is one of those landmark papers that's going to go down in history as, you know, that people are going to cite this paper for a long time. And, in fact, you know, I was reading an article, and I cannot remember where, it was really interesting on impact factor and kind of what a joke it is.
Right.
Because it turns out that there's impact factors and there's numbers and you assign them to journals. But they change as a function of time. Post-publication of that paper. Mm-hmm. So impact factor has to do with the number of citations. Mm-hmm. And the number of citations for science papers, it turns out, drops precipitously. So the impact factor, like a year after the publication, is much higher than the impact factor 5 years or 10 years after the paper. By contrast, JBC has the opposite trend. Right. So the impact factor starts out, you know, maybe lower on the scale, but it increases with time. So 10 years or even 5 years after the publication date, the impact factor of a JBC paper is higher than that of a science paper, and that's a statistical fact. So, I relayed this story to Chris, and I said that, Chris, 5 years from now, nobody will remember what was published in Science 5 years ago. Half that stuff was probably retracted anyways. You know, there's a lot of boo-boos in Science and Nature, but, you know, it's flashy, quick stuff, you know, and some of it, you know, might have a long-term impact, but a lot of it won't, because it was hot today and it was gone tomorrow. I said, but this paper will last. This is a paper that people are going to cite for a long time, and that's important, you know. What else can I say?
Right.
You know what I mean?
And where is he? What's he doing now?
He's going to go postdoc with Graham Warren, who's a cell biologist at Yale. So Chris has now become fascinated with the Golgi compartment, and he has, as he phrases it to me, so glycobiology is really at some level the study of the function of the Golgi compartment, because the Golgi compartment is basically a very fancy set of an assembly line that organizes enzymes so that you can post-translationally modify proteins. That's fundamentally what it does. Not just glycosylate them, but fold them and get them in the membrane and so on. But glycosylation is a big part. So you have 300, in the human genome, 250 glycosyl transferases and about 50 sulfotransferases, and all of them are in the Golgi compartment. All of them, right? It's a lot, you know, to pack into this one space. So that is the primary function of the Golgi, and yet most glycobiologists don't think that much about the Golgi compartment and its architecture and its biogenesis and its dynamics. They really don't. They think about what's the product. It's this sugar, and you study that. And then likewise, you have this whole Golgi community, and it's this really tight little Golgi, like sort of aficionados. There are a lot of high-tech electron microscopists and so on. And most of them don't know a thing about glycobiology. So they study the structure of the Golgi, but don't really think about what's its primary function, because it's hard to think about sugars, you know. So Chris says, I'm going to be the guy, you know, who takes like this function of the Golgi and understands the structure of the Golgi and kind of puts them together. And so in my lab, you know, he has spent 5 years being the world's expert on how glycosylation takes place in the Golgi compartment. Now he's going to go work for Graham, and Graham Warren is one of these aficionados of the most fancy microscopy technique you could think of to pick apart all little aspects of the Golgi and cut it and see how it heals and look how it grows from scratch and so on. And I think it was a really good choice. So Chris has a vision for his scientific interest. And so it took me like 5 years, you know, but after 5 years, I really feel like here's a guy who is not cut up in whether his paper was in Science, Nature, or something, and is not cut up in, well, what's everyone else interested in, and that's what I should do too so I can get a job. And, you know, that's not it for him. It's all about the Golgi compartment, you know. He reads a Golgi paper, and he's up all night thinking about it, and he wants to talk about it with me at 8 a.m. the next morning, and that's what makes him a great scientist, you know what I mean? So now I can only hope, as he goes out to the world and applies for jobs, that I can write a letter that conveys that sentiment, so that the people who are evaluating his job applications will hopefully read that letter, and that will be a letter unlike any letter that they are used to seeing. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. And I can honestly say that about this guy. It's not just like, oh yeah, he's my student, you know, of the 40 students I've worked with, he ranks in the top blah, blah, percentile. Yeah. And the, you know, it's not going to be that kind of a, that's another superstar. That's not this kind. Yeah. It's a different guy. That one is going to postdoc at Harvard Med School for Hida Plu. Do you know Hida? He's a viral, I mean, sort of a viral antigen processing guy. Yeah. Biologist.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, well, what has this
guy went to Carleton, by the way. He's a really good writer.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, good. Well, so what is this? What's the impact of this paper on your own lab? The direction of where your lab
huge.
Is going?
Oh, huge. Okay.
Yeah.
And I'll
so
tell you
are
why.
You going to be like a new Golgi fanatic as well?
Well, I'm a Golgi amateur. It really takes a long time, I think, to become one of those Golgi people, because again, the microscopy is all. It's all about microscopy, and I don't have that sort of background. And if I had Chris forever in my lab, I could do it, because he has the intellect, he has the drive, and he has the passion for it. But when he goes, which is going to happen this year, I don't really have anybody behind him who I think can carry that torch. You know, there's other torches they'll carry in different directions, but I don't see anyone doing exactly this. But I'll tell you what did happen, which spun out a whole new project. So there we were, like, mucking around in the Golgi compartment, and it's funny, I had actually never really thought of this. You know, I mean, I had been working with sugars for a long time, and I knew that glycosyl transferases put them together, and I knew that these are membrane-associated Golgi enzymes, but I had never really sort of made the leap to, like, how the organization of these enzymes in a physical sense might encode a biosynthetic pathway. I just never really thought of it that way. And this problem sort of opened my eyes to that. And there's another sort of big problem in glycobiology, which is that we have kind of a dearth of chemical tools that we can use to study, like, processes. And one of the most useful chemical tools that, as a biologist, you can have is an inhibitor of the enzyme, you know, that you want to study. So, you know, if you're a kinase person, it's really great that you can buy storosporin and it inhibits protein kinase C, or you can just buy like some little toxin and inhibits your G protein. And you know, these are tools you buy from Cal Biochem, and you can see whether, okay, is that process, does it involve protein kinase C or does it involve this G protein? And there's nothing really like that for the glycobiologists. And the reason is that these enzymes, the glycosyl transferases, which are kind of what you'd like to hit because they're biosynthesizing these things, they're just really hard to block with small molecules. They don't lend themselves to small molecule sort of inhibitor design, and it has to do with aspects of their structures, and I won't go into the details. But so there has been no way to kind of perturb glycosyl transferases with small molecules, like switch them on and off. And I should say there has been no way to do it in the conventional enzyme inhibitor sense, where you target the catalytic domain with an inhibitor. And so when sort of the story started coming together, you know, a bunch of us were like, well, gosh, you know, this is a whole other dimension of glycosyl transferase function. Yeah, their catalytic domains are catalyzing reactions, but their ability to do that is really dependent on their proper positioning in the Golgi compartment. So what if you mucked with that? You know, what if you targeted their Golgi localization, not their catalytic activity? And so it's like, you know, if you're talking to me and I want to inhibit you from doing that, there's two ways I could do that, right? I could stuff a ball in your mouth, and that's the conventional inhibitor, or I could stick you in another room, right? And so we started thinking about, well, is there some way we could just relocate these enzymes in the wrong place, and then they'd basically be inactive? And so we figured out a way to do that, and so I kind of have to draw it, but then it won't get tape recorded.
Yeah, that's a problem with the
anyway, so we figured out a way to do it, and basically what we do is there's two domains. All these enzymes have the same domain architecture. They have a catalytic domain and a localization domain, and these things are part of one polypeptide, and so localization domain puts them in the membrane, catalytic domain catalyzes reaction. So what we do is we separate those two domains. Now they're two separate proteins, and localization domain goes to the Golgi compartment, but catalytic domain isn't attached anymore. It just gets spat out of the cell, okay? So that's inactive. So then what we also do is we fuse to each domain a little small molecule binding protein that doesn't really interfere with the domains because it's pretty small. And there's a small molecule, it's a drug, that we feed the cells, and the drug binds to both things at the same time and glues them together. So basically, in the absence of the small molecule, the catalytic domain flies out of the cell, no activity. In the presence of the molecule, it gets glued together to the localization domain. Now it's in the right place, and it catalyzes the reaction. So that small molecule flips the enzyme on and off, but not by attacking the catalytic domain, by affecting the localization. And although that is kind of a separate problem from this one, this project really inspired that. And so that's what Jen Kohler has been working on, and she's now on the academic job market. She's the one from Bryn Mawr, who's a great writer. Yeah. And two new graduate students just finished their first year, have projects in that area too, and we just submitted a big NIH grant, you know, to get some funding for that. So you could say that that is a spin-off of this project, because it was inspired by this one. So when Chris leaves, you know, our interest in the Golgi compartment will probably be in that venue. But unfortunately, Chris is a real hard bird to... This is going to be a tough act to follow, because the cell biology in this project was really significant. It's complicated, and it was difficult. And this guy's a chemistry student, and most of my students are chemistry students, and they're not up for it, most of them. They want to do synthesis. That's why they came here. They're not, you know... And Chris was very open-minded, didn't care what his technique was. He just wanted to solve a real interesting problem and found his calling in the Golgi compartment. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a lucky find for me.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you have written a more kind of review article on glycobiology and kind of the state of glycobiology a couple years ago. And where do you see your future research interests heading? So where do you think you're going to be like 5 to 10 years from now?
I don't know. You know, I think it's going to depend on who ends up in my lab and, you know what I mean, what they want to do. Because the stuff we're doing now, I don't think I could have predicted 5 years earlier. So likewise, you know, I mean, I hope that we continue to make important discoveries that move the field of glycobiology forward, provide new chemical tools, make some new fundamental discoveries. I like having a balance of real fundamental work, like how do things work, and also developing cool tools that you can use to do things, you know. It's nice to have a balance of kind of snazzy, sexy stuff that you put in a PNAS in science, and also some real kind of fundamental stuff where you can really develop a full story and quantitate the shit out of it. Sorry, the hell out, heck out of it. You know, and then do really scholarly work that, you know, nobody might ever read, but you feel proud, you know, you did it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But exactly what, you know, systems, I mean, 5 years from now, probably will hopefully still be working in TB, although exactly what we're doing will depend, again, on the people that come through here. Yeah. So it's so, you know, so dependent on the people.
Right.
I hope I get good people, you know. I hope I continue to get good people who have these great ideas and are kind of bold, you know, to go out and do things that are new and not afraid to bring new techniques into the group.
Well, again, to use one of these tired old criteria for one of your papers with Rosen in Current Opinion in Cell Biology was considered a hot paper by
that was a review
scientists.
Article.
Yeah, and
it
was a
review
article.
It wasn't even
article.
Like a paper. Yeah.
Right.
Because it was the selectins.
Right.
And they were
and
hot.
They were hot, and it kind of put all the information anybody needed to know in one place. And how well did this initial selectin project fill your kind of expectations?
Oh, it was way more than my expectations. I mean, the selectins were really, so L-selectin was the receptor on the lymphocyte that was involved in recirculation. That receptor binds to the sulfated polysaccharide that these enzymes sulfate. So all that's kind of part of this story. The great thing about the selectins is that they turned out to be far more complicated than anybody anticipated. And that was a bummer, actually, for the pharmaceutical companies. Because, again, back, you know, early 90s, all these companies got really excited. And part of the reason this was so hot is because people were like, oh, my God, this is a new inflammation target. And inhibitors of the selectins are going to be broad-spectrum anti-inflammatory agents. And every company had a big selectin program at that point. And this was pivotal for the field of glycobiology because until then, sugars were considered kind of the Special Olympics of biology, you know, and not that interesting and kind of weird and, you know, of no significance in medicine and pharmaceuticals. So then out pops this family of receptors that are like the very first stages of leukocyte adhesion at sites of inflammation. They bind to sugars. And all of a sudden, immunologists had to learn about sugars and people in pharmaceutical industry had to learn about sugars, and they were like, oh my God, oh no, you know, I never read that chapter when I was under. So that just, the glycobiologists became really important because we held the key, you know, to understanding these things, and companies wanted to hire carbohydrate chemists for the first time ever, you know, which was great. And it just brought a lot of attention to the field, you know. So like glycobiology meetings before then, like I went to a couple as a grad student, like Keystone meetings and stuff. They were small, it was like 100 people, and you know, kind of like fringe element type, you know. And then after the selectins, like a few years later, these meetings were like oversubscribed and they were huge and you couldn't get in, and that was a big deal. So, but at the time, people vastly oversimplified what they thought the ligands for the selectins were. And pharmaceutical companies tried to develop drugs based on these simplified view of these ligands, and all those programs failed. So by the mid-90s, no big company had a selectin program. Yeah. They gave up. It just wasn't flying. And companies, you know, they can't wait forever to get a hit on something. So now it's a bummer because, again, you used to have these meetings that were like, the whole meeting was the selectins. That was a whole Keystone meeting on the selectins. Now you go to some glycobiology meeting and there's like one little poster on selectins. No one even works on it. You know, it's just like people kind of were like frustrated, gave up. But there's going to be a renaissance. Okay. And I'll tell you why. Because now...
we heard it here first.
No, it's true. And because 10 years later, now we do understand the true complexity of these ligands. Like we didn't back then. And they're much more complicated. There's, I mean, I won't even go into all the complexities, but sulfation was a part of it. That wasn't even known in the early days. Yeah. That came out like in 95, 96, after all these programs had bailed out. So now we know much, sort of, we have an idea of what the real ligands are. We've identified the enzymes involved in the biosynthesis of these ligands, and those enzymes are now attracting attention as drug targets. And enzymes are probably going to be easier to inhibit than the actual selectins themselves, which are receptors. Because enzymes are in the cell and they catalyze reactions, they have hydrophobic binding pockets, and you can target them with drugs. So it was that recognition that sort of spawned kind of the second generation companies like Thios Pharmaceuticals, yeah. Right? Okay. So, you know, there's UC patents on these sulfotransferases, and this is some of the intellectual property on which we based that company. So Steve and I and another former postdoc from Steve's group formed Thios. Around sulfation as a kind of niche for drug discovery, including this enzyme and some others too. So, and we were able to raise money for that company, which wouldn't have been the case earlier in the 90s when people were really bumming on the selectins, you know. Yeah. So we did all right, you know, despite the economy and so on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to be jumping around a little bit here, but I'll pursue this. Why start a company?
Because you know in your heart that you have a really interesting target for a disease, a really big disease category. And, you know, you've been working on slaving away in your academic lab for all these years, and you want it to come to fruition. And you start every paragraph of every paper and every grant with, you know, these enzymes are important in inflammation, and inhibiting these enzymes could be a way of blocking inflammation. And you want to realize that. And you can't do that in academia. You sort of have to do it in a company. You need the resources, you need the personnel, you need the infrastructure, and the right commercial motivation. So that's why we did it. We had been kicking around the idea since I was a postdoc in his lab. All of us were like, oh, we should start like a sulfate company. And none of us were in a position to do it. I was a postdoc. The other founder, Stefan Hemrick, was a postdoc.
Right?
Steve had a big collaboration with Genentech at the time. He was kind of tied and couldn't really do things on his own. And then, you know, years later, I got tenure here, so I was a little more secure. Stefan had been at Roche in Palo Alto for about 6 years, so he had now a pretty good idea of the drug discovery process. Steve broke off with Genentech, and time was right, you know, so we finally said, let's just do it, you know. And we did it, and we hired Stefan out of Roche to come and be the first employee of Thios. And then we started hiring from other pharmaceutical companies to get experienced people in, like, medicinal chemistry, high-throughput screening, target validation, crystallography. And now we have a fully integrated company. It's a small, it's a startup company, probably about 30 people.
Yeah.
And we raised our first round of venture capital financing in... We sort of closed that deal in April of 2002. April 2002. So we've now been operating for about a year and a half. And we raised $15 million in that first round. We did all right.
Yeah, okay.
And it was fun for me because it was something different. You know, I had no idea. I'd never started a company before. I thought it would be a learning experience. And I thought it would be really fun to create. And one of the things I liked about my lab is come in, empty space, clueless first-year students, and create out of nothing something, you know. And starting a company is the same thing. You go in, it's nothing, and you raise money, and just from nothing you create this entity, and now you're employing people, and you have these ideas, and you're putting together business deals, and so on. And it's really, really fun, actually, but a lot of work.
Yeah. And why stay in academia?
Well, I had actually the opportunity to move to this company. So I had an offer to go there as, like, the head of research, like the chief scientific officer. And I thought about it really seriously. And there were mornings when I woke up and I was like, I'm going to do it. But then, you know, I look at my little students and, you know, for example, such a privilege, you know, to work with someone like Chris, right, and Howard and Joseph and Jen, all these people, you know. And I don't think I could duplicate that in industry. I mean, there's smart people that you hire there, but you have a different mission and you don't get to see them. You don't get to see them sort of develop and find themselves the way that you get to see these students do that. You know what I mean? To have, like, some kid come in out of some undergraduate place, doesn't know anything, knows a little chemistry, a little biology, but not much else, and then comes out of here, like, with his eyes, like, burning passion about the Golgi compartment. You know what I mean? That's, like, so precious, you know? So that, you know, it would be hard to sort of give that up. And Joseph come in and become, like, all about tuberculosis. And when he came in, it was, like, nothing. It was like blank, kind of, you know what I mean? And now, like, this guy's like a purpose, and this is what it is. And I feel like I kind of got to see it, and I got to catalyze it. And then I get to follow them around afterwards and see what they do. Like, my first student ever, PhD student, to graduate is now, she just started on the faculty at UT Austin. And she has her own website, you know, and it's, you know, I mean, I don't have kids of my own, you know, so this is kind of how I, you know what I mean? This is the only way I get to kind of feel that sort of, probably feeling of pride, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well,
plus, you know, I come and go as I please. Nobody tells me what to do. I don't have to report to people. And I don't have to, like, make milestone slides and, you know, and answer to investors. I mean, I do at Thios, but I don't hear. And I think that would drive me nuts, kind of, if I had to do that for my vocation, not my avocation, you know.
Yeah. Well, one can argue that there are these... constructs we have in place called patents that, you know, can maintain a barrier between academia and industry.
Mm-hmm.
And the University of California is one of the pioneers in this area, whereas 50 years before, universities had policies that said you can't patent anything. And now, you know, everybody has a material transfer office or technology yeah. transfer office at all their universities. And one very famous way is Berkeley had an agreement with Novartis that the technology would be here and through a patent would be licensed mm-hmm. for commercialization with the biotech company, and those would be separated. And why have you chosen to blend the two? Because you do own patents, and you could just license that to Thios and not have anything more to do with it. Why choose to be involved on both ends of the spectrum?
Well, the rule for me, maybe I don't know the rules that well, but at Berkeley, anything I discover at Berkeley belongs to UC.
Right.
So any of my scientific discoveries from my lab, you know, that has to be UC, that's a UC patent. And then Thios can license that patent from UC, and they can pay for the patent preparation class in exchange for the first right, you know, for an exclusive right license. But that's, I don't really have a lot of flexibility in how I do things. That's sort of that's my only mechanism. I can't, you know, and also being a Hughes investigator imposes certain limitations on, like, what
right.
I can do. Like, I can't take money from Thios to do research here,
right.
where Thios, in exchange for that money, gets, like, some special right to the patent. Thios has to compete for my patents with everyone else. The only advantage they get is they can have the first right to compete for an exclusive license if they pay for the patent preparation cost. That's the best that they can do. So, you know, it's actually been really simple for me here just because I really don't have any other option. I can't license things directly to Thios without going through UC. I'm not allowed to do that. And I think even if I'm at Thios, let's say I consult for them a certain number of days a year, right? So
right.
if I consult over at Thios and I come up with some idea at Thios,
mm-hmm.
it's even then, like, it's blurry whether Thios can really own that idea, you know, without...
Because
right. that idea would have to be completely uncoupled from Berkeley. But the truth is that the science at Thios is a spin-off of what we've done at Berkeley, what Steve did at UCSF, and so on, you know? And they've licensed several of my patents or negotiating a license, and they've hired my former students, you know, and they work there, you know what I mean? And so I try and keep it clean, you know. I mean, if we make a development at Berkeley that I think is of interest to Thios, I don't tell Thios about it. I can't. I have to first file a disclosure with UC, and only then, after disclosure has been filed, UC can disclose that disclosure to Thios and so on. I have to be really careful about that. But it hasn't been that hard, because Thios is a drug discovery enterprise. And in our lab, we're really doing basic research. We're not doing drug discovery. We can't. We're not set up for that. It takes too much, you know.
Yeah. Well, in this whole area, the controversy is this conflict of interest. How do you maintain...
I don't see it as a conflict. You know, I see it as a synergy. Because basically, you know, if we make discoveries here, we'd like that to have some impact outside of, like, the thesis to collecting dust on my shelf, right? So... the way to have impact is start a company and try and, you know, realize the commercial potential of these discoveries. And I just have to make sure that I never exploit a student. You know, I have to make sure that I'm not having students work on a project for Thios. You know, that can't ever happen. Students work on their work. They publish their work. They write their thesis. If there's something I think Thios is interested in, we file a disclosure on it before we publish it. The student is a co-inventor. So if there's royalties to be made, the student gets a piece of the action. You know, so the student's good for the student. And it's good for Thios. Now, mm-hmm. Thios would really like it if they didn't have to negotiate with UC. You know, if these
right.
could be Thios patents and not UC patents. But that's life. That's the way it's
yeah.
going to be.
Yeah.
Nothing I can do about it.
Right. Right. And then to follow is that, you know, funding happens in different ways for contemporary biomedical research. And most of it, you know, we haven't talked about your funding, where most of your funding comes from.
NIH.
I know you're Howard Hughes. Mm-hmm. But NIH is publicly funded,
mm-hmm.
and commercialization means, you know, privatization of a certain aspect of certain ideas,
mm-hmm.
and so part of this conflict of interest is, you know, is taxpayers funding research in one institution that they'll have to pay for in another sector?
Uh-huh.
And there's one way to regulate that is just to have, you know, kind of ethical standards by which scientists regulate what gets worked on where.
Mm-hmm.
But in the absence of ethical behavior, and there's always problems with that, how do we regulate how standards are upheld.
I don't know. You know, when I was a grad student, I heard stories about people, you know, professors having their students work on projects that were really for some company, you know what I mean, and having even their notebooks, students' notebooks getting photocopied in the middle of the night and copies sent to the company, which, you know, you're not supposed to do that. I've never been in a position where I worried about that, just because, I mean, you know, for us, it's like, if I think something is going to be of interest to Thais, I patent it. It's that simple, you know what I mean? And then Thais can decide how interesting it is to them. They can either license it or not. They can decide, nah, we can get around that. It's not that important. If I don't patent it, that's no good for Thais. That's no good for anybody. Because if I don't patent it, that means anyone can practice it. And if no company can get the intellectual property protection on it, it might not be worth it for them to pursue it. Because they have no exclusive, you know, someone else could compete with them, and why should they get involved if they don't have IP rights, you know what I mean?
Right.
So in a way, you know, if you don't file a patent that someone can license and practice and get exclusive rights to, there's a chance that nobody will ever practice your invention. And that's, I don't think that's really that good either. Mm. You have to, it depends on the invention, you know, you have to really think carefully about what is this invention. So I have, there are some things I never patented because I didn't want to ever limit anybody's access to it. Like research reagents, you know
right.
what I mean?
Yeah.
Or if I had patented them, like I made the mistake of patenting one early on,
yeah. okay.
and then Molecular Probes licensed that patent, and they sell that reagent in their catalog now, but they charge an exorbitant price for it. No one else can sell that reagent because Molecular Probes has the exclusive right to market it as a research reagent. And so it's no one can afford it from them, you know, and I feel like, oh, that stinks. Now, if I hadn't patented it, Molecular Probes still might have chosen to sell it in their catalog, but so could Sigma, and so could yes. someone else, and there could be a little bit of competition, and the price might be a little more reasonable. On the other hand, you know, if I hadn't filed a patent, Molecular Probes might have said, well, the market's too small, and why should we even bother right. investing in this reagent unless we can get exclusive rights to it? Otherwise, we have to share the market with other people. It's already a small market. So you sort of have to think about, you know, how's the reagent going to be used? Is it good or bad if you patent it, and make a decision based on that? But again, whether you patent it or not, you always should be driven by optimizing the commercialization potential so that you can get it out into the community. That's how I see it.
Yeah.
So now there are other reagents since then that I have not filed patents on because with the hope that anybody could use it, sell it freely, and that it wouldn't get locked up to one company who then overcharges for it or just decides not to sell it at all but just sits on the patent without practicing it. But other things I have patented because I know that if Thais, for example, cannot get secure intellectual property rights to it, it's not going to be worth it for them to pursue it because of the risk of competition.
Yeah.
And I do want someone to pursue it, and Thais is the only game in town because this is the company that's doing sulfation. So if it's a yeah. patent having to do with a new high-throughput assay for sulfate enzymes, a new enzyme that we discovered from some genome mining or something, target we validated in some way, then I will file a patent on it, yeah.
Yeah.
Or at least a disclosure.
Right. And I think you have like 13 patents or patent applications pending. And I didn't look at them specifically in at the patent office database, but I'm going to assume that you're listed one of the inventors and the assignee is the University of California.
Yeah, with the exception of a few of them, there's a few of them are LBL patents,
okay.
actually.
Yeah.
Because
okay.
And that only means right. that the funding came from LBL.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay. How much royalties do you see, and where do those royalties go?
Like nothing. I mean, you know, like only a few of these patents have actually been licensed.
Okay.
Some of them are just, they're sitting there and UC would love to, they shop them around and would
yeah.
love it for someone to come and express an interest in a license. But some of them are too new, I think, to really have caught the eye of potential commercial, you know, enterprises. But yeah, those that have been licensed, I haven't seen any royalties yet because it's too soon. You know, they are patents having to do with like a drug discovery program where there wouldn't be any royalties to see until 10 years from now when there's a drug on the market that was developed using that assay or using that against that target or something. So mm-hmm. I don't expect to see anything for a long time, if ever.
Yeah.
Because even then, once royalties start coming in, the royalties, first they get used to reimburse the university or LBL for the cost of executing and maintaining the patent. And then once the patent, because the patent costs money to maintain,
right.
so once the patent has, when all the expenses have been satisfied, then whatever's left, you know, then you divide it with all the inventors, and it's me and all my students. And so, you know, I don't think there's ever going to be a lot of money in any of these inventions, but if there is, might as well be me, you know, and my students.
Yeah.
The only thing, I get like a few hundred bucks a year from a contact lens patent.
Okay.
We have a contact lens material that we developed, and but that royalty is not royalty from the market, because that material is actually still in a clinical trial. It's not even commercial yet. It's a royalty that just came from an upfront cash payment that was part of the licensing agreement for the company that licensed it.
Okay. Let me pop in and yeah, yeah.